welcome to the final hour of Shattering Myths for today. As I first read through this and studied this prediction in Yeshaya 17, I was a little bit troubled by the fact that this statement from Yahweh lists the thinning of Yisrael immediately before the harvest. Now, at the time that I first studied this, I had no idea whatsoever as to how Damascus and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan played into the prophecy. It just seemed, well, what on earth is God talking about? How is something in Syria and Damascus and Jordan and Lebanon going to play into this? And, of course, now we're witnessing this before our very eyes. It's the dominant story in the news when America is not tongue-lashing the Russians over the mighty Crimean Peninsula. And yet, even with now Damascus and Syria and the Syrian proxy war understood, when we know of those things, and we can understand how that leads to the treaty that thins Israel, giving up her land for baseless promises of peace, it's still a bit troubling to have the harvest occur after this in a succession of events. And the reason that that strikes me as a bit odd is that if you just look at Daniel and you try to put a timeline around the events described in Daniel, you come to the conclusion that the tribulation is going to be ushered in by a peace treaty that's going to be advanced partly by the Torahless one, the fellow known as the Antichrist in Christian circles, by the Torahless one, and that he's going to somehow be associated with this peace treaty that is affirmed by many nations in concert with Israel, and that would be the opening salvo, if you will, for the tribulation. And under those circumstances, for God to keep his covenant children out of the tribulation, they would have to be harvested before this treaty. And so there was some concern as to how does all of these pieces fit together in terms of the time. Now, I want to say that the treaty that ushers in the tribulation doesn't have to be signed on the first day of the tribulation. And it can have more than one author. We're not told that the Torahless one is, in fact, the only author of it, just that he is a proponent of it. And we are have no indication as to whether the harvest proceeds or follows this treaty by days, hours, weeks, or months. And the only thing we do know is that these things happen in very quick succession. And there is also no the designation of the type of treaty that is reaffirmed between Israel and the surrounding nations that is attributed to the Torahless one in the Daniel. So this particular agreement that has been presented here in Yeshaya thins Israel at the waist. It forces Israel to return to what I would suspect will be 1967 lines, which makes Israel enormously vulnerable, about 5 miles wide, where 70% of the people live. That's pretty clear. The other treaty that is reaffirmed isn't specific. So it could be another agreement that occurs right after this that ultimately is the prelude to war. But anyway, the timing, I thought, was interesting because you're trying to put together a timeline that is going to explain the events that are going to transpire over the next 19 years. Now, God has said that based upon everything he has said, there's every reason to conclude that the Teruah harvest is going to be fulfilled before the worst of the tribulation carnage begins. And that is what this prophecy says as well. Israel is thinned at the waist, no longer being sustainable. God harvests his children. And then the onslaught, a tidal wave of Islamic jihadism, floods into Israel. So, and then you follow that by, after the terrorists are blown out of Israel by God himself, there's a warning to America, and based upon what Americans do at this point. So, he has the harvest where it belongs before the carnage of the tribulation begins. Also, it seems reasonable that the treaty alluded to in Daniel that ushers in the tribulation will be predicated upon Israel sacrificing land, thereby shrinking the vulnerable nation to the waist, to the dimensions perhaps depicted in UN 242. There is no guarantee that that they are the same agreement. It could be two related agreements, one which strictly sacrifices the land, that one that the United States is proposing, and it could be a second one later that is that makes Israel particularly susceptible by perhaps creating a demilitarized zone in Israel where the nation just becomes absolutely susceptible. So, I had thought that Israel would become vulnerable all at once when I first began to consider these prophecies, with the Gaza and the West Bank being surrendered at the same time, because I went to these words and began to translate them long before Gaza was surrendered. But now we know that this is an ongoing process. Gaza was lopped off in 2006, and the West Bank has only partially been ceded to the Islamic antagonists. Therefore, the peace treaty sponsored by the Torahless One will entail yet another foolish concession, one that perhaps goes beyond the succession of land. Also at issue, we don't know when the Syrian war will end. There is every reason to think that it will rage on for quite some time, perhaps another decade. In fact, I suspect, when I read this timeline, that the Syrian proxy war will continue through 2023, 2024, perhaps even into 2025. But I suspect it's going to continue into the 2020s. And that being known, we do not know if it's going to be weeks or months after Damascus is destroyed and the Syrian government is deposed before the final surrender of territory surrounding Jerusalem, surrounding Ramallah and Jericho and Bethlehem and Hebron, and that all of these areas are offered up to appease these Islamic terrorists who will be committing grotesque acts of terrorism worldwide when they return home after the calamity in Syria. And we have not been told how many months or years will pass after the sliver of land between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv is sacrificed before the Magog War begins, although that's the next thing we're going to read in this prophecy. So one thing is known for sure. A great deal is going to happen between now and the fall of 2026, and when the tribulation, which is when the tribulation is likely to begin. Islamic jihadists will continue to commit ruthless acts of terrorism. Damascus will lie in ruins. The government of Syria will fall. The West Bank will be sliced away to create a Palestinian state. And Yahweh will come to remove his children just before the world is engulfed in a deadly war. The metaphors that Yahweh uses in the next statement serve to identify the subjects who are being addressed. Olives are consumed as food. Their oil was used as a healing ointment. And there's no better source, at least there was no better source of light in the ancient world than olive oil. These traits, along with the fact that olives were firmly rooted in the land of Israel, and that they are the longest living trees in the region, all serve to illustrate the influence of the set-apart spirit in our lives. She brings light to dark places. She nourishes her children, healing and empowering them. And Yahweh's set-apart spirit distinguishes and separates those who live with God from those who die. Continuing to talk about this harvest, this gleaning, in Yahshua 17:6, God says, "So in him," this would be in Jacob, so we're talking about in the covenant and in Yisrael, among the 12 tribes. Both would be considered in him, in Jacob. "There will be those who leave." This is from Sha'ar. "There will be those who live and those who are left behind. Remaining is part of a group for a duration of time. So in him there will be those who live." This was written in the Nifl Perfect Consecutive, which indicates that each individual will be harvested or left based upon the choices they have made regarding these gleanings. "So in him there will be those who leave and those who will be left behind. Those who leave will be gleanings, as in going around an olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top, the uppermost, the choicest branch. Four or five on the fruitful branches, which have been cut away, which are separated," prophetically declares Yahweh, the Mighty One of Yisrael. So here we have a transition from standing grain, the standing barley, established, to an olive. To the olive is the longest living tree in the region. To olive is the source of light, as the olive is the metaphor used throughout Yah's testimony to describe the benefits brought to bear by his set-apart spirit. That the ripe olives here now are the first fruit, and we have two groups that are being harvested, both distinguished. So in him, in Jacob. Now, Jacob would represent the covenant. He represents Yisrael. In fact, he was renamed Yisrael, so we could just call in Yisrael. Now, in Yisrael, what does Yisrael mean? Now, it's really important that we understand these terms. Now, first, Jacob is a name which describes someone who walks upright and steadfast, digging in their heels. And I think I shared this in one of the previous programs, that if you try it sometime to walk really digging in your heels, it makes you extremely upright. Your countenance is even lifted so that you're looking up to the sky. It's a marvelous way to walk it. And when you dig in your heels, which is what Jacob means, you're not easily pulled side to side. When you're concentrating on stepping forward heel to toe, then you're walking forward. You're walking in a straight line as opposed to going astray. And you're not easily pulled away. That's what Jacob means. But Yahweh specifically renamed Jacob, who was Abraham's grandson, Yisrael. So it's imperative that if we want to know who God is talking about here, that we understand that Yisrael is a name that is based on three Hebrew words. Actually, two Hebrew words and a Hebrew name. It's Ish, which are individuals. Sarah, which was Abraham's wife, she is the mother of the covenant. She represents the set-apart spirit in the metaphor of Abraham representing our Heavenly Father. Ish, Sarah, the mother of the covenant. Sarah means to engage with, to endure with, to be empowered by, And then El. El is the Hebrew word for Almighty God. So individuals who, as a result of the covenant and particularly the maternal aspect of God's nature in the covenant, engage and endure with God. That's what Him represents here. And in the among these individuals, there'll be those who leave. And those who leave will be gleanings. That means this is a secondary, a small harvest. And the numbers here are interesting. The first number is 2 or 3. The second is 4 or 5. If you take the lowest number and the highest number, or the, 2 and 5, you have 7. If you take the higher number from the first and the lower number from the second, 3 and 4, you have 7. Now, almost everything that Yah communicates to us is based upon that model of 7. And it's based on 6 plus 1. That, 6 days, God created the universe, and it is 6 24-hour days from our perspective, which is 14 billion years looking back in time from our perspective here on earth. In the seventh day, he rested. There are 6 steps to God, and the seventh, camping out with him in the Moed Mikre, and he's called out invitations to meet with God. It's everything that God communicates that's important is based upon 6 plus 1. And it's important because man, who is a carbon-based atomic number of 6, life form plus God, who is 1, equals God's idea of perfection, which is us being together. 7. 6 plus 1, 6 together with 1 is 7. And so we have an indication of that. The other indication we have is an affirmation of what was written on the second of 3 statements on the first of the 2 tablets, where God said that thousands will benefit from his mercy by observing, closely examining, carefully considering the terms and conditions of the covenant. That's what's occurring here. And so we're going to have, God is telling us, there's going to be 7,000 people. Now, of those 7,000 people, which is, by the way, 1 in 1 million, because there's 7 billion people alive on planet Earth today. Of those 7,000 people, there's going to be 2 groups. 2 or 3 from one group, 4 or 5 from the other. Both are depicted as ripe olives, so they are olives that are filled with the Spirit. They are olives which are illuminated and enlightened by God's light. But the first of the 2, the smaller number, is from the top, the uppermost and choicest branch, which would be the branch of the Maaseiah, direct descendants of Jacob. And we'll consider the other in a moment. As we look at this particular prophecy, Yeshayah 17:6, we have the gleanings this time from the olive tree. And we've described why the reference, the metaphor of the olive tree here is appropriate. What it, the olive tree represents in terms of the uniqueness of these individuals, enlightened as they are with the set-apart spirit. That there will be 2 or 3 in the top, the uppermost and choicest branch. The uppermost, the choicest, the highest branch is the branch that from which the Maaseiah has emerged. It is the branch of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. They are native-born Israelites. And when God describes his covenant, he goes into great deal of detail describing the instruction of circumcision as the sign of the covenant, and it being both for the native born in the family, in the home, which would be consistent with this highest, choicest branch, and also of those choosing to be adopted from foreign lands, those who are separated, but still on a productive limb, this ka'af. And it is four or five that are on the fruitful branches that are separated. And so when you look at these two and the depictions of them, it's evident that God is speaking about 2,000 or 3,000 Israelites, descendants, naturally born descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. And 4,000 or 5,000 Goyim, who have been adopted into the covenant based upon the choices we have made to accept its conditions. 7,000 in total. It's a very, very small harvest, particularly considering the fact there will be 7 billion people on the planet at this time. Hello, Diane. Did something that we've said spark a question or a comment?
It did. I just love the show.
Okay.
Anyway, I just wanted to ask you, when you were talking about Jacob's name being, Jacob's name being changed to Israel, there was another an instance in the scriptures where it says it in the writings that he was talking about his name being changed to Yeshurun, which Yeshurun means upright one.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you have you investigated any of that? I just assume what
it's all
about
yeah
that.
it's they're they all convey the same concept that that Jacob, one who supplants his heels, is upright. If you walk that way, you are really upright. And to be an individual who engages and endures with God, who benefits from the Yahweh's maternal nature relative to his covenant, then you are among those who is kumbaya, upright, with Yah. And so to describe Yisrael and Jacob as being upright and as being the upright one makes perfect sense. Now, you know, the ultimate manifestation of the upright one is, of course, the Yosha. But Yosha is descended. He's the seed of Jacob in terms of his material manifestation.
But he wouldn't
go ahead.
He wouldn't be in, because if Yahshua was here as supposed to be as, but God in the flesh, whatever. But so
right.
He would be pursuing
diminished manifestation of Yahweh in the flesh. So not, you know, all of God doesn't fit into our solar system, much less our planet, much less into a finite human form. So it's a you know, grossly diminished manifestation of Yahweh's nature is required by E equals MC squared.
So I was just wondering, and if the name, because you were saying that it was changed to Israel, and I was just wondering why it would not have been, because Yeshurun has Yah's name in it, and he says, my people will be called by my name, and Yeshurun. And even because there, it means upright one, and all the time, even when he in Deuteronomy, when it's talking about Yahweh himself, he says, "I am righteous and upright." And
right.
They're using the term upright, and even with Yeshua, he was upright, always upright,
right.
So he would be therefore a Yeshurun.
Yeah, you know, as a matter of fact, the Hebrew term for righteous is tzedakah. And the primary meaning of the word tzedakah only yields righteousness because it means to be upright. So to be upright, to be right, is to be vindicated and righteous before Yahweh. And in this particular case, name takes the relationship one step further. You know, you've got beginning with Jacob, he digs in his heels. He is steadfast in his relationship and his walk with God. A pretty good name. I like that name. That's Jacob. Then he becomes Yisrael, which is an individual who engages and endures with God. And then as the names progress, it's not just God. It's God's name that is that his name now incorporates God's name, and he's upright with Yah, which is a it's even more powerful indication of what we all become in the covenant. We our names become incorporate Yah's name. We become, you know, if my adopted name Yada holds, then you know, I look forward to being Yada Ben Yahweh. And so we are all going to gain Yah's name as part of our name because he becomes our father.
Okay.
So it just strikes me, Diane, that all of this, yeah, all of this is consistent. It follows the same train of thought, and presents those who are in the covenant. And you know, you look at Jacob, Yahweh expressly tells us that Jacob is part of the covenant, and that he is forming a covenant relationship with the descendants of Jacob. So it would make perfect sense that Jacob is one who stands with Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
The now, upright with Yahweh.
I've been pondering that name for quite a while, Yesharon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when you talked about it just a minute ago and you were like, just talking about upright one, it just like, okay, I got to solve. So thank you for the explanation.
My pleasure. All right, as we look at this prophecy, that 2,000 or 3,000 Israelites are going to be gleaned, and 4,000 or 5,000 Goyim who have been adopted into the covenant. The first thing that we should recognize is that God is not verbose. He didn't go into the 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and differentiating where they come without a reason. And so if you just look at this as, oh, well, you know, it was a prophet who wrote these words and he was just trying to be poetic, you'd be wrong. This is Yahweh speaking. And God doesn't say anything that isn't useful to our knowledge and understanding. And so here we have 2 and 3 from one branch, 4 or 5 from another branch. They are, by the way, part of the same olive, always also ripe. But the smaller number that is associated with the uppermost and choicest branch, and the larger number with the fruitful branches, which have been cut away, which are separated, yet which would be people from foreign nations, as is the depiction of the covenant when Yahweh tells us about the sign of the covenant, circumcision, is designed to identify, to quantify, and to distinguish the relatively small number of individuals who will be taken home. The smaller of the two communities represents Israelites, the direct descendants of Jacob, who will be harvested at this time. And the larger number represents Gentiles, who will be gleaned as adopted children as a result of embracing the conditions of the covenant, also affirmed through Jacob. Both participants in this secondary harvest of some 7,000 souls, the naturally born and the adoptive, will leave the earth on the Mikra of Teruah following the destruction of Damascus and the thinning of Israel, but before the final Islamic assault against God's people and land. Now, if the smallest and largest numbers, the 2 and 5, or the largest and smallest numbers, the 3 and 4, are harvested from each community, then 7,000 members of the covenant will be brought out of the world into Yah's home on this day. Our Heavenly Father would have every reason to protect His children at this time, removing them from the corruption and carnage that is about to be unleashed on the world, leading His children away to life from the valley of death. If these extrapolations are accurate, the Teruah gleaning isn't very far away. It is set between unfolding events. The ongoing destruction of Damascus, the depopulation and fall of Syria, the disposition of Israel's midsection, but prior to the time that Muslims react, or Israelites return to Yahweh in mass. This is a fairly narrow window. So we should keep a keen eye focused on Syria, expecting the conflict to continue until there are so few civilians on one side or the other to kill that the surviving Islamic jihadists turn their weapons and rage against Israel. We should expect that the U.S. will continue to remain on the wrong side, to try to impose its will, and that Israel will eventually capitulate. We are told that when this occurs, the children of the covenant will be taken home, removed from the valley of death, so that they do not have to endure the tidal wave of Muslim militants who will flood into the promised land, leaving death and destruction in their ways. This is going to be a gruesome scene, but fortunately, we will leave at this time. And God even tells us that at this time, His attention is going to be focused on us. But before He does, God is telling not those who have been harvested, but those who remain, how different heaven will be from the conditions experienced on earth. Now, there are a number of intriguing words in the Word of God which encourage us to think before we jump to conclusions. One of these is Sha'ar, which was translated, there will be those who leave in the previous statements. Now, some lexicons suggest that it means to remain, as in left behind. But those who are left behind can't be gleaned, and God goes right on to say that that speaking of them being gleaned. So if you're one of those being brought together and harvested, you aren't being left. So since Sha'ar has two different meanings, they're related. It speaks of those who will leave, which means that others are left behind. You really need to think before you translate any word, particularly in context. Now, most Hebrew dictionaries assert that the primary meaning of Sha'ar is to leave. So, personally, I suspect that both concepts apply, depending on who is being addressed, recognizing that when some leave, others remain. Both connotations possible. Let's re-examine God's presentation in context, beginning with His reference to Yisrael, because that's who He's addressing here. He says, the children of Yisrael, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. And it will come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable, and the fattest, best protected, and most important midsection of his body shall be lean, shrinking in size. And it shall be like the gleaning, the in, a receiving of a harvest, reaping the grain from the chaff in season, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby establishing and validating the standing grain. And with his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and ability to shoulder burdens, his visible appearance as light, he will be collecting and harvesting the first fruits. And it shall be as a gleaning, as a smaller secondary harvest of ears of grain in the valley of Rephaim, in the midst of souls destined to die. So in him, in Jacob, who has become Yisrael, there will be those who leave. Sha'ar. There will be those who will live, those who will be left behind, remaining as part of a group for a duration of time. Written, of course, as we pointed out, in the Nifl perfect consecutive, meaning that each individual will be harvested or left based upon the choices they have made. These gleaning, smaller, secondary harvests, as in going around, as in encompassing and shaking off, as a means of harvesting an olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top, uppermost branch. Four or five on the fruitful branches, which have been separated. Prophetically declares Yahweh, God of Yisrael, of those individuals who engage and endure with the Almighty. Well, since the picture being drawn before us and after the mention of Shar depicts a smaller secondary gleaning. Those being harvested are leaving. They will live, while others remain, being left behind, destined to die. Jacob is thereby being used to describe Israelites in general, most of whom will be left, as well as the covenant, all of whom will leave. Since the earth's population will be around 7 billion people at this time, if God is depicting 7,000 olives from both the uppermost, choicest, and the cut-off branches being called home, we have yet another affirmation of the thousands figure denoting the quantity of those saved in the second statement that Yah etched in stone. There he revealed that thousands, which is just one in a million, will receive his mercy by observing the conditions of his covenant. Now a third, even larger harvest, will follow some 7 years or more later when Yehudah and Yisrael unite in their love of Yahweh. This will occur on the Mikra of Yom Kippurim in the Yovel year of 6000 Yah, on a very important date on our calendars, October 2nd at sunset in 2033. Year 6000 Yah, the day of reconciliations. And with that thought, we'll bid adieu for today. Look forward to being with you at this time tomorrow. May Yah bless.